From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It is the first day of a brand new year. For most of us, that means creating a list of resolutions we hope to honor for at least a few months. But this year, a few select Democrats and Republicans have one main resolution. That's making it into the White House. It's an election year, and with a viable black candidate and female candidate running for president, 2008 is already history in the making. Here to give us a preview of the elections and other political stories of 2008, we've got James Taylor. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. We've also got Michael Fauntroy. He's a professor at the George Mason School of Public Policy and the author of Republicans and the Black Vote. James and Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have this election season breathing down our necks after what seems like months and months and months and months and months of previews and debates. The first primary is just days away. The top political story for 2008 is sure to be this election. First, though, I want to discuss the recent news in Pakistan. Opposition leader Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. Reports are saying this might be the work of al-Qaeda. Michael, does the attack on Bhutto set a tone for what's to come in the region in 2008?
Well, quite frankly, I don't see how it couldn't. You know, it is no surprise, sadly, I must say, that Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. And the fear that many people have is that this will lead to a destabilization of Pakistan. I think that concern is very well warranted. President Pervez Musharraf's hold on the country is somewhat leaky, if you ask me. And so I see that as a tremendous concern for the country, for the region, and it will reverberate into the U.S. presidential election.
When you think about what's going on, James, do you think that the U.S. is going to take a stake in what's going on in Pakistan? So far, we have, as a nation, the government has looked at Pakistan as a bulwark against Islamic extremism. Is this a bulwark that can hold?
Well, that's a good question. But I think one things that we sort of need to sort of pause and think about is prior to September 11th, the summer of 2001, I think in June or July, there was a great deal of concern about both Pakistan and India sort of testing their missiles across each other's borders. And that was sort of the most sort of, you know, tenuous and sort of threatening moment in terms of nuclear power and nuclear threat. And then what happens, I think, in the end is after September 11th occurs, Pakistan and India were off the table. But initially it was Pakistan and India. And then India, of course, invokes the possibility of China, all of these major nuclear powers coming together in very tense international relations. So the United States, of course, needed Pakistan to be strong. But it appears that there's a great deal, as Michael said, of instability there.
Do you think that the presidential candidates here in the U.S. are going to have to reframe some of their arguments for 2008 around this happening, this assassination in Pakistan? What do you think, Michael?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. I think that the campaign and the candidates are now going to have to move from sort of theoretical, hypothetical discussions to more specific, real case studies because what's going on in Afghanistan, and by the way, you know that President Hamid Karzai and Benazir Bhutto had met just hours before she was assassinated. And at some level, they both had a shared concern about their positions and in the positions of their countries relative to growing democracy in that part of the world. And so I think that the candidates going forward are going to have to really focus and explain in far more detail than some of them may be prepared to about how they would deal with loose nukes, the democratic process in that part of the world, and how they would foster and encourage democracy. The reality is we've been sort of stuck with Pervez Musharraf at some level. He's not a Democrat. He took power in a coup. And relying on someone like him to bring about democracy in Pakistan is very problematic. And so the candidates are going to have to be very nuanced, as I see it, in how they address this going forward.
James, what is the importance of foreign policy overall? People have talked a lot about Iraq and even a bit about Afghanistan, but there's also this enormous economic threat looming over the United States, even across the world, the ripple effect of the mortgage crisis in the U.S. How's that going to pan out against the international issues?
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think you could even include immigration into that whole sort of question. And it seems to me that in terms of American foreign policy overall, and I mean the weakness of the dollar on the international markets, the American sort of reputation in the world, of course, has taken a tail dive. So it just seems overall that America is in trouble. Our military is stretched beyond its capacities throughout the world. 500,000 soldiers is the size of our U.S. forces. And we have, I think, about 150,000 over in the region of Iraq and Afghanistan alone. So American foreign policy, I think, is something that will force, I think, some of these candidates, such as, I think, like Huckabee and Giuliani, who were gaining a great deal of momentum on these domestic issues and sort of these wedge issues like immigration, now to sort of be much more concrete about issues that they don't have any experience on. And I think Huckabee already is sort of revealing that he doesn't really have a good handle on foreign policy. People like, I think, Biden and Dodd and Hillary Clinton tend to show stronger and have greater strength as a result of this terrible tragedy in Pakistan and the violence in the whole region.
What's going to be on the table as we enter the Iowa caucuses? I mean, this is really right here, right now, after so many months of almost being here, maybe being here, debate about who will get here. Now's the time for people to start making up their minds in these primaries. What do you see ahead in your crystal ball? I'm just going to have to ask each of you that.
Well, I see a tremendous, tremendous battle on the Democratic side. You know, the Iowa caucuses that are coming up in just a few days on Thursday will be very curious to me, not for who wins the first round of balloting, but who is the second choice candidate among the second tier supporters. That is to say, those who support Bill Richardson, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, for example. And all of the polling that I've seen so far, it suggests that John Edwards is the most favored second candidate amongst those candidates, the supporters of those candidates. So it suggests to me that John Edwards may actually be able to pull out a victory, if not a very strong second place. On the Republican side, you know, I tend to agree that the occurrences in Pakistan have come at a pretty bad time, politically speaking, for Mike Huckabee, in that he does not have the gravitas in terms of foreign policy experience compared to someone like John McCain, for example. And so when you look at it in those sort of raw, stark political terms, I think going forward, what you're going to see is the people who have the most experience or the people who are perceived to have the most experience or be well experienced rising to the top.
What about the Republicans?
Yeah, I think with the Republicans, I think the same thing is true. I think you'll begin to see someone like a John McCain who the assassination of Ms. Bhutto, I think, really sort of sets John McCain apart from many of the other candidates in terms of his foreign policy experience. He cancels Rudy Giuliani out in terms of Giuliani's ability to raise the specter of September 11th. John McCain was already gaining momentum in the Iowa and in New Hampshire, like Edwards was on the Democratic side. So suddenly this terrible thing happens in Pakistan, and it shows that John McCain is someone who is of much more substance in terms of a foreign policy understanding of world affairs. And I think that bodes well for him. So I think we're going to see some movement in John McCain. I think the likes of Romney and Huckabee and even Giuliani, stars will continue to sort of decline. Giuliani, of course, is putting all of his chips in Florida, hoping to win as a national candidate. And it is true that McCain did win in 2000 in Iowa and did not win the presidency. So winning Iowa and New Hampshire, I think, is important for someone like a Barack Obama, for someone like a John Edwards. But I don't think in the long run it's that important, except for sort of momentum and the ability to talk about electability and fundraising. But I think the likes of John Edwards, John McCain come out of this moment looking better than people have predicted up to this point.
Michael, what about this whole idea of South Carolina as the black primary? There are a lot of big contests that happen back to back to back. Is South Carolina going to be influential?
I think for Barack Obama, it's going to be critical because mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, if he doesn't win Iowa, it's going to be very difficult for him to win New Hampshire because the winner of Iowa will have some momentum going into New Hampshire. And, and is likely to be the winner or second place in New Hampshire from my perspective. And so that really does hang, that really does require Obama to hang his hat in South Carolina, because he hasn't really done very much campaigning in Nevada. And so if he doesn't pull it out in South Carolina, I just don't see how it's possible for him to win the nomination. And by the way, he suffers just in the same way that Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney and also Rudy Giuliani do in the foreign policy experience category in the wake of the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. And so he's got to figure out a way to capitalize on whatever momentum he gets coming out of Iowa and New Hampshire to really win South Carolina, because I don't think he can lose South Carolina and win the nomination.
I agree. I think he has to sort of demonstrate, as Jesse Jackson did in 1984, the ability to garner, you know, the black vote in South Carolina, and even few moderate or liberal whites in South Carolina. So that's a very critical state for Obama. He can't afford to lose South Carolina, as Michael says.
But let me add one more thing there. And I think you're right. I want to add, however, Jesse Jackson was native to South Carolina. Mm-hmm. He had very deep roots in the state. And, mm-hmm. and he was able to win in large measure running a protest campaign. Barack Obama doesn't have the same connections to the state, and he is not running as a protest candidate. And so I would not be surprised if his share of the black vote in 2008 falls far short of what Jesse Jackson did in 1988, for example.
Sure.
All right. Well, we'll keep that crystal ball open. Thank you, gentlemen.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking with Michael Fauntroy, a professor at the George Mason School of Public Policy. He joined us from our headquarters studios in Washington, D.C. Also, James Taylor, he is an associate professor of political science at the University of San Francisco, and he spoke with us from Sports Byline Studios in San Francisco.
Tell me, say one thing, Nancy, if you understand. One thing, Nancy, if you understand. One make them a talk about me ambition. Say one make who them a talk about me ambition. Come and say some of them ask me where me get it from.
Just ahead, we look at Africa in the year 2008, gazing into our crystal ball, and later, why so few women of color had corporate departments and teams.
What a bum.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On today's Africa Update, a look at what lies ahead in 2008 for Africa. A woman is slated to take the helm of the African Union, plus upcoming presidential elections in South Africa and a preview of President Bush's trip to the continent. For more, we've got Amira Woods. She's co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Farai. Such a joy to be with you.
So let's start with the African Union. They are likely to get a new head this month. You say it could be a woman. Who is that?
Well, all eyes, Farai, are on the Zambian ambassador to the U.S. She is Dr. Mbesita Lawanika, and she is likely to be the first woman chairperson of the Commission of the African Union. And as many of your listeners know, the African Union is relatively new. There's been really one chairperson of the commission, Alpha Konare, the former president of Mali, and he in January will be stepping down after this first five-year term, and it's very likely that a woman will take the helm, and all eyes are watching anxiously to see what will happen this in January.
What are some of the challenges facing the African Union, and how might she address them?
Well, the biggest challenges are around peacekeeping, around governance issues on the continent, but really around issues of creating a continental stance on key questions from an Africa command of the U.S. to key economic integration questions. Will the African Union become more like the European Union with one currency? These are some of the questions on the table right now for the African Union, and the new leadership will help decide the direction of the African Union in the decades to come.
Well, let's move on to the upcoming presidential elections in South Africa. Last month, Jacob Zuma won the battle for leadership of the ruling party, the African National Congress, or ANC. He is now likely to become the country's next president, but last week, South African prosecutors filed new corruption charges against Zuma that include racketeering and fraud. Back in 2004, Jacob Zuma was deputy president of South Africa, and he spoke with NPR's Tony Cox and addressed corruption allegations against him at that time.
I was not near the process of influencing anything with regard to the allegations that have been made, insofar as the charges that have been put across, there's been nothing found. There was no interference by the deputy president or by the government institutions, and the investigation went on for more than 3 years.
Amira, these are persistent investigations that have gone on, and there have been some that have been resolved. There's also a sex scandal. He was acquitted, but he did admit to having sex, which he says was consensual, with an HIV-positive woman who was a bit of a goddaughter figure to him. This is a lot of baggage for a politician. How can he move forward?
Well, it's so much baggage. I mean, some of his views have been controversial, but clearly Zuma is the populist candidate. He is seen as the candidate of the people, the candidate who can really represent all of those discontented voices who have felt pushed out, marginalized by the party since 1994. You know, a party made a grand bargain where the corporate elite would essentially keep their wealth. You know, many people in South Africa are saying the transition is much too slow. There are unrest with escalating unemployment. There have been issues in the textile industries with people being pushed out of jobs. This onslaught of China coming into South Africa really forcing factories to close. So the economy is really putting people in a miserable state. And Zuma is looked at by many as an opportunity to regain a balance where the masses can assert their right to economic freedom, to economic determination, now that the political freedom has come in the post-apartheid era.
When you think about South Africa being an economic and political engine for the continent, how does a Zuma presidency looming ahead affect that nation's ability to navigate the international waters?
Well, let's be clear. You know, the finance minister of South Africa, Trevor Manuel, said it clearly right after the vote in the ANC. He said, you know, that much will remain the same. And we have to understand that there are global forces at play. There is an International Monetary Fund, a World Bank, a World Trade Organization, where corporate interests are so dominant and controlling the world economy that it will take time for countries to put forward a different path that puts the needs of their people first. But I think the hope from those masses that are supporting Zuma is that Zuma will at least represent those voices of the marginalized poor to say we cannot only have corporations dominating. We must look at issues of healthcare in a country that is ravaged by the HIV/AIDS pandemic. We must look at issues of education. It is those core building blocks of the future that people are hoping will come about under a Zuma presidency, if not in the short term.
Next month, President Bush heads to sub-Saharan Africa. What's the purpose of the trip?
Well, Farai, what we're concerned about is that the establishment of this U.S. military Africa command will dominate issues of this trip. And the concern is that Africa's agenda, which, you know, as we were talking about with South Africa, is education, it's housing, it's good jobs, it's healthcare, you know, those things on the agenda for most Africans will, you know, remain really off the table during and after this trip.
How will President Bush be remembered? He is in the waning year of his presidency, what we call a lame duck president. How will he be remembered, do you think, by leaders on the continent?
Clearly, what the Bush administration has done is gone their own way. And they have done it through establishment of an AIDS fund called PEPFAR, the Presidential Emergency Initiative on AIDS, you know, at a time when the whole world came together to do establish a global fund for HIV/AIDS and tuberculosis. The Bush administration went their own way. There is also a going their own way around development and development aid. So that, again, the Bush administration created the Millennium Challenge account, you know, when the rest of the world was coming together to figure out how to work together. And many say it has really pushed forward U.S. objectives, particularly in banking and finance, to open up African markets, and really not benefited the poor nor even the middle class in much of the African world. So, you know, it is a mixed review when you look at the Bush administration. Clearly a lot of wonderful photo opportunities. But in terms of the substance of the Bush policy when it comes to Africa, I think what remains steadfast is a sense of a military approach first.
Amira, very briefly, give us a hint of two big conferences coming up. There's an African Union conference and a UN conference. What are they?
Well, they are extraordinary opportunities. First, the African Union Conference. The African Union has said that they have established this Region 6, reaching out to all of the diaspora, Afro-descendants, wherever they may be in the world, connected to the African Union. And the African Union will go forward and have a conference of this diaspora in 2008, including African heads of state, and it will be hosted by South Africa, seen as an extraordinary opportunity to put on the table core issues of engagement with all of the African world and the African continent. The other conference is really one being pushed by the UN, and it's fantastic. It is an agenda that was started back in Durban now, you know, quite some time ago. It's a review of a conference on racism, reviewing issues of racism and xenophobia in 2008. So these are two extraordinary opportunities for the African world to come together to bring public consciousness and political will to a much under-addressed issue.
Amira, thank you so much for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Farai. Wish you all the best, you and all your listeners.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She was at our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. A new book explores the largely untold history of activists in America who have fought for the freedom and equal rights of Africans. No Easy Victories was co-edited by William Minter. He became involved with African activism while teaching school in Mozambique during the 1960s and 70s. Minter says several multiracial groups and individual activists emerged in America to support African liberation. Sylvia Hill was one of them.
Sylvia was part of a group called Southern Africa Support Project that had worked in D.C. in terms of education and mobilization around South African liberation in the local community, in the churches, with the trade unions, in the schools. And it was really the people connected with that group, mostly African American women, who were the key people who, behind the scenes, put the demonstration together.
What were some of her accomplishments?
What Sylvia and her group, and she would be the first person to say it's not one person, it's a group, were able to do was to build the understanding of South Africa so that when it really hits the television, when it really hits the news, people are ready to be mobilized.
When you think about movements like this, this happened to be about South Africa, but social justice movements in general, is there a tipping point where the force of the movement, you can almost feel it building? Because there are many people who want to accomplish many things in this world. Not all of them get accomplished. Some don't get accomplished for decades. Was there a moment when you could feel the debate shifting on South African apartheid?
I think in terms of people's awareness about South Africa and the United States, you can really point to a succession of events taking their initiative from things happening in South Africa and from the struggle there, and then a response here and around the world. So the African National Congress organizing the Defiance Campaign Against Apartheid in the early 50s, with thousands of people getting arrested for defying racial laws, actually several years before large numbers of people began to be arrested in the campaigns in Montgomery and otherwise in the South. That had its impact here, both in terms of really also it was one of the examples that people here built on.
That's not necessarily known a lot, that people inside the U.S. civil rights movement would look for inspiration to Africa.
Exactly. And that's sort of one of the things that we wanted to do our book about. There's a very nice quote from Nelson Mandela that we cite in the book. When he first visited the United States after being released from prison, he was interviewed by a reporter from Ebony Magazine who asked him, this may not be the exact words, but it's what I remember, "Mr. Mandela, can you tell us, you know, how your movement learned from or gained inspiration from the U.S. civil rights movement?" And he answered very diplomatically, "Yes, you are correct. We have many similarities, and we have learned much from each other." It goes both ways. and it did go both ways. And the impact not just of South Africa, but of the independence of Ghana, and on a broader scale, the independence of India and Gandhi, had a tremendous impact here that is really neglected. It sort of dropped out of the history. And people, even when they tell the history of the civil rights movement, they tell it as if it was something just happening here, and as if it wasn't part of the same wave of resistance leading to the independent anti-colonialism, anti-apartheid. I mean, the fact that these happened at the same time, they were interconnected, they weren't just, you know, completely separate tracks. In a sense, one can almost see the breaking of this connection in the 50s, because it was very clear during World War II and right after World War II, and with respect to anti-colonialism and race, people like Paul Robeson, people like W.B. Du Bois clearly made that connection. And one of the things that happened during McCarthyism is that there was really a crackdown on this people making this connection, because it was seen as communist, as unpatriotic, to move to an emphasis on, you know, the U.S. civil rights movement is really patriotic, and emphasizing the fact that clearing things up here in terms of race would improve our chances in the Cold War, instead of conceiving it as it's a common struggle.
It sounds to me like there have been waves, or what you're describing is waves of connection and fissure between African Americans or people looking for racial justice in America and African liberation. So where are we now on that wave?
Post-apartheid is in a sense similar to post Civil Rights Act in the United States. One has gotten rid of racism, discrimination, and segregation on the books from the legal structure. But the consequences of that, those decades and generations and even centuries of oppression, are not in the past. They're present. However, it becomes extraordinarily more complicated when the differences, when the inequalities are not blatant written into law. In a sense, some of the most effective organizers for the civil rights movement were the white policemen in the South who beat up protesters, just as the white South African regime was one of the most effective organizers for the anti-apartheid movement, because they were so obviously evil. Today, whether in Africa, in the United States, or around the world, it's a lot harder to figure out who are the bad guys and who are the good guys. We're almost in a building period when the connections have to grow enough, the knowledge has to grow enough before one can even organize, either on an Africa-wide basis or an Africa-U.S. Basis, campaigns that can really make a difference. So how does this happen? We don't have any answer, except that it has to be through people and networks. And one of the things we emphasize in the book is that one of the most critical networks now building is the increasing number of activists from new African immigrants. That was also true before in a different way. I mean, many of the key people who made organizing help in the United States, it wasn't just Americans, whether white or black. It was African exiles. It was African students. It's hard to see how it fits together. The issues, whether they are conflict, whether they are economic underdevelopment, whether they're HIV/AIDS, whether there's the new U.S. militarism helping to back an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia. We really went through several decades of educating people. I mean, not abstract education, but political education, before it could grow enough to make a difference. And I think, you know, not that one gives up on making an immediate impact, but one may have to think, you know, in terms of a 20 to 30 year time frame.
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
William Minter is the co-editor of the new book, No Easy Victories. He is also the editor of Africa Focus Bulletin, and he spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. Next on News and Notes, what's keeping you from reaching your dreams and getting women of color to take charge in corporate offices? I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Imagine growing up in the projects of South Chicago, making your first $1 million by the age of 14 and your second million by the age of 16. Farah Gray doesn't have to imagine that is what he did, and he's devoted much of his life to sharing what he learned along the way. His new book is called Get Real, Get Rich, Conquer the 7 Lies Blocking You from Success. How you doing?
It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's hard to go into all the different things that you've done because they have been different. But what was it that made you want to be a self-made man?
Growing up, and I think that much of who we are, we can trace it back to our childhood experiences. My grandmother always says that children are practicing adults. So for me, it was growing up not only in poverty, but also growing up just wanting to know what made one person succeed, why another person failed. I always wanted my family and I to live like the people we saw on TV, like the Cosby Show. So that's what really sparked my process of discovery as it relates to personal development.
In this book, you talk a lot about how people relate on an emotional level to concepts of wealth and poverty, self-determination. One of them is that you really need to have a success mentality that allows you to be flexible, living below your means, keeping yourself healthy, wealthy, and wise, physically healthy, spiritually healthy. How does all of that tie together for you?
Well, I started working on this book, and I've learned and experienced so much. I do about close to 150 engagements a year. And I met so many people that were blindsided by so many things that society, I think, has convinced many of us of. And when we look at the fact that so many people believe that it takes money to make money, or they believe that the only way to be successful is to be a celebrity or to have zero debt. There are just so many big misconceptions. So with this book, I wanted to really inspire people to find their area of excellence and to realize, as I've discovered, as one of the greats of our time once said, that the two most important times in a person's life is when we were born and when we find out why we were born. So I think that this book really demystifies what so many people believe as it relates to success, financial wealth, and what I call being rich from the inside out. And that's how really they come together, because I believe if you don't go within, we'll end up going without.
We're entering a new year.
Yes.
And people make a lot of resolutions. One of them is often, I'm going to get my financial house in order, including maybe buying a house or starting to save more. What's the difference between a resolution and the successful change in your attitude?
Well, I think we need less resolutions and more executions. We need to move beyond conversation towards accomplishment. I think when we make not only a promise and we put it out there in the atmosphere, we have to make a promise to ourselves. And I think that we have to look at the new year and say everything is going to be great, as I like to say, in 2008. And then moving forward, we begin to realize that comfort, I think, is the enemy of achievement. And that's what has stopped so many people from achieving the levels of success that they really want to achieve. So I think that's what has set a lot of people back. But I feel really positive about this new year. And I feel that a lot of people, and we'll see a change around the world, we'll even see a new president.
In this book, you have
which is another subject for another time.
It is a long subject, and we'll have to talk to you about it. But when you think about some of the concepts we're talking about, they're big concepts. Give me a concrete example of one small, relatively easy thing that you could do that would help transform your financial future.
First, I think that I call it the celebrity moment. I think that many times when we look at the majority of this country, we're living paycheck to paycheck. And we have what my grandma used to always call a J-O-B, a just over broke position. And we don't look towards wealth development. I think the first step towards wealth development is deciding, what do we do with our paycheck? Many of us watch television all the time, and we want our celebrity moment. We admire the way that celebrities live. And this is one of the lies I talk about in the book. It's called the celebrity lie. We believe that these celebrities live the best life that money can buy, and we want our moment. And it happens at the wrong time. our celebrity moment happens when we get our paycheck. So I always encourage people to live below their means. Many people believe that they're already rich, and they go out and they buy things, and I call them liabilities. So they end up sitting on their assets, lying about their ability. These are things that we generally cannot afford. We don't need to go and have an expensive $5 or $6 cup of coffee. We don't need all the features on our cell phones. We don't need all of the various latest cars and gadgets. We end up buying things, and I think many times we buy things because it equates to, I think, self-worth. So I would think that would be the first thing. Second thing I would encourage everyone for the new year is find your area of excellence. Find what God put you here to do for those who believe in God. I do. Concentrate on the things that you're great at. I always say ask yourself three questions. What comes easy to you but harder to other people? Second question, what would you do and work for years and years and never have to get paid for it? And the third question is how can you give back and how can you be of service? And I found that, and I discovered how to be of service. I'm the spokesman for the National Coalition for the Homeless. So I believe it's important to give back. So I believe once you're able to answer those three questions, you will have a prosperous and strong financial new year and definitely create multiple streams of income based upon your gifts and your talents. Very quickly, I have a 9-year-old goddaughter. She just submitted a poem, and she said, "You always told me, do what you love to do." Now she got a book deal, and she has agents looking at her, all because she was within her area of excellence.
Farah, thank you so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Farah Gray is the author of the new book, Get Real, Get Rich, Conquer the 7 Lies Blocking You from Success. The number of black and brown people in the U.S. workforce keeps growing, but only 15% of supervisors are women of color. When you hit the boardroom and executive suites, things get even worse. Ella Bell has been tracking workforce diversity. She is an associate professor of organizational management at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth University. Welcome.
Well, welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm delighted.
Happy New Year.
Yes, Happy New Year. So, who are we talking about when we say multicultural women managers?
Well, you think about the 4 racial ethnic groups that we consider pretty traditionally in this country: African-American, Hispanic, Latino, Asian, Pacific Asian, and Native American. And then when we add multicultural, what we've done is we've broadened that out to also include women from the immigrant countries, Latin America, Asia, Africa, the Caribbean, and Middle Eastern women, because Middle Eastern women were definitely being left out. And because white women have a culture too, we also include white women in our working definition at Ascent, leading multicultural women to the top.
When you talk about such a broad array of people, people born in the U.S., people born overseas, white women, black women, etc., are you really putting apples, oranges, papayas, mangoes all in the same basket?
We're making a fruit salad here.
Exactly.
Well, when you look at the workforce, the demographics of the American workforce, all of those women happen to be in the workforce today. So the fruit cocktail, as you so nicely put it, is already in existence. It's how do you get the women from these various backgrounds to recognize that they have something in common, and that if they work together and form alliances with each other and coalitions with each other, then we might really be able to see a difference in the social fabric and the demographic fabric in the American corporation.
Why? Why does this matter? Not just to people of color, not just to women, but to America?
Well, this is what it matters greatly. There's this magic number, 83%. Many years ago, the Hudson Institute came out with this Workforce 2000. And they talked about that the entering workforce would be 13% white male. We've, over the years now, transition that, and we talk about 83%. And we look at the 83%, what we're talking about are women and people of color really entering into the American workforce. And when you think about that 83% women, when they say women, they're really talking about white women. And then the women of color come under the minority group, if you will. But what we know about that entire number is that when we start talking about the people of color, that most of those people of color are women, because the men, particularly African-American men and Hispanic men, are not in the pipeline to enter the workforce. So why is this important? We're talking about the backbone of American companies, which happen to be very global. Let's be very clear about that. But we're talking about the workforce and the advancement of our industry base as we know it being more female. And how do we prepare those women, not just white women, but all women? And that's pretty critical. We're actually talking about the backbone of the American workforce within the next 10 years, if not sooner.
Are you talking about people who might be entrepreneurs and starting up their own businesses, or people who might be at Fortune 500 companies?
We're talking about the people in the Fortune 500 and smaller, mid-sized American corporations as well. What's happening, while we do see a greater number of women entrepreneurs, some of that is happening or occurring because of the fact that women are very frustrated and they're taking upon their own selves to develop their own companies because they're not being able to advance the way they think they should within the corporate side. So they're forming their own businesses and companies. And we also see that women who have had children who would like to reenter American corporations, the companies they left, they don't see a way to reenter those companies, so they wind up starting their own businesses. That's one of the reasons why that number is increasing.
When you think about someone who might be 2 or 3 years into working at a corporation and starts seeing a lot of her colleagues leaving because they can't put up with this, that, or the other, how would you advise someone who is just beginning to feel the full impact of race and gender to negotiate a way to stay in business, if not in that specific corporation?
Well, you know, Farai, you have to be very clear about what you want. I always tell women, first of all, that the grass is no greener on the other side. Even if you want to start your own business, you really need to have some corporate experience underneath your belt to establish your network and to really learn about business from the inside, if you will. But one of the things I like to tell women is to be very clear about what you want, to be able to establish a work plan for yourself so that you know exactly where you want to be within the next year or two. Be sure that you've discussed your goals with your boss, with your manager, make sure that they're on board with you, that you have allies that will help kind of put the word out about who you are and the work you're doing. Perform, perform, perform. I cannot say that enough. Good performance, people notice. Don't be afraid to blow your own whistle and to, you know, build an effective team around you that will support you. The other thing is get the word out. Don't keep yourself in isolation. Volunteer for different task force, different opportunities so that you can create a presence for yourself. Don't look at other women leaving and saying, okay, this is the way my fate is going too. As my mother used to say, you know, everybody could be jumping off the roof. That doesn't mean you do it too.
Professor, thanks so much.
You're so very welcome.
Ella Bell is Associate Professor of Organizational Management at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth University. She also founded Ascent, leading multicultural women to the top. She joined us from Charles Holloman Productions in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's time for StoryCorps Griot. African Americans across the country are talking with family and friends as part of this traveling project. Today we hear from 11-year-old Keontre Compton. Keontre lives in Omaha, Nebraska, and he participates in his local Big Brothers Big Sisters mentoring program. That's how he met 38-year-old Stuart Chittenden. Here, Keontre and his mentor Stuart talk about their friendship.
So how long have we known each other now?
Probably a year.
Does it feel that long?
Yes.
Yeah.
More like 19 years. When I first met you, I thought this was going to be so boring, it's going to ruin my whole summer, my whole life. But then you taught me respect. You taught me how to be mature. You taught me how to be a young man. You know how I ask you all the time, why are you so polite? Why are you so respectful?
Mm-hmm.
I understand that you're just trying to be a good mentor to me. And I love that. And there's times when you messed up. Like, you taught me that it's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to get mad, but it's just not okay to get out of control. So, Stuart, what are the things you believe in? Like, if you believe in God, are you scared that he wouldn't pick you to go to heaven or anything?
Well, I don't believe in God. So I don't have a faith like you have a faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I do worry about living my life now to be the best that I can be. Does it bother you that I don't have a faith in God?
Sometimes it makes me shocked, but no, that's your belief. I can tell you one thing. You're the best role model I ever had.
I think we're teaching each other stuff.
Which makes us more closer.
Mm-hmm. I want you to know that this isn't a one-way relationship. I'm learning how to be fun and engaging and open, and so I want to thank you for that, Keontre.
You're welcome.
Do you think we're going to be friends for a long time?
You really want to know what I think?
I do.
I think we're going to be big brothers for a long time.
Keontre Compton with his mentor, Stuart Chittenden, in Omaha, Nebraska. All the GRIOT Initiative recordings are archived at the Library of Congress. A copy of each interview will also go to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. You can read dozens of stories like this one in the first ever StoryCorps book, Listening is an Act of Love. Hear more at nprnewsandnotes.org.
StoryCorps is sponsored by AT&T. Funding for StoryCorps GRIOT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. No spaces, just nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we've got two Iowans describing how the White House race is affecting Black life in the Hawkeye State. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.